Outrage grows over a 4-cent jury award for a Fort Pierce family after police shoot and kill the father of two young kids. A closer look at the Gregory Hill case coming up. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9, and thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We are always live on the radio at 9. Also, make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Just ahead, have you heard about this 4-cent jury verdict in Florida? We'll tell you why the case of Gregory Hill Jr. is getting national attention. You can get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, African Americans sound off about the school choice movement. It's our real talk today on the show. Plus, Jacksonville singer-songwriter Lee Hunter. We've got a preview of her show this week at the Mudville Grill. All of that and more ahead this morning. But first this hour, a controversial jury verdict here in Florida is sparking outrage across the country. Now, after police shot and killed a Fort Pierce man back in 2014, the family of Gregory Hill Jr. sued for wrongful death. But after nearly 2 weeks of trial and 10 hours of deliberation last month, a jury down in St. Lucie County sided with police in the case. And the 8 jurors decided that it was Hill who was largely to blame for his death because he was drunk during the confrontation with law enforcement. Not only that, the jury awarded what amounted to 4 cents to Hill's family. 4 cents. How can that be? Well, Jacksonville attorney John Phillips represented the family of the late Gregory Hill, and he's expressed disgust and amazement to a series of national media outlets over this jury verdict down in Fort Pierce. Phillips says the case could eventually be retried and could potentially be pushed toward the Supreme Court. So how did this happen? How did Gregory Hill die? And why did the jury award such a paltry amount to the family? John Phillips joins us now with the latest on the case of Gregory Hill Jr. and takes your calls. John Phillips, always good to see you. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
And here's our question to callers. Have you heard about this 4-cent jury verdict to the family of a Florida man shot and killed by police? It was over loud music. We've heard that story before. Give us a call right now with your thoughts and questions at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And we welcome your comments, too, on our First Coast Connect Facebook page. All right, let's begin, John, I guess, with the facts of the case. Here's what we know. Gregory Hill Jr. was killed the afternoon of January 14th, 2014. He was 30 years old. He was off work from his job, and he had been drinking, and he was listening to music in his garage at his home in Fort Pierce, Florida, what he kind of called his man cave. Those facts are not in dispute, right?
No dispute.
So then what happened?
So a mother across the street, so Mr. Hill lived across the street from a school, and a mother called police over hearing Drake's All Me. There's F-bombs in there. And at the time she called police, the garage door was up. Mr. Hill saw people starting to arrive, put the garage door down, was sitting there drinking water. There's water on top of the stereo system and listening to music. Police arrived, spent about 59, 60 seconds on the premises from the time they got there to the time they yelled shots fired. And the cop knocked on the garage door, knocked on the front door, left marks in it. As he was returning back towards the garage door went up. According to the lady who called 911, the officer appeared startled, jumped back, fired 4 shots, 3 struck Mr. Hill by the time the garage door was completely down. So he raised it, said, no thanks, lowered it. And that, you know, those facts are generally not in dispute. The question becomes, in full disclosure, a gun was found in Mr. Hill's pocket. No blood, no DNA, no tissue, no nothing, no significant DNA at all identifying it as Mr. Hill's. And police say he brandished that gun. Mm-hmm. We say forensically it was impossible. Motive movement based upon the shots, it was impossible. The fact that from that shooting angle that and where Mr. Hill was shot, the gun couldn't have been where they said it was. And those were the issues for the jury to determine.
And so the jury weighed that evidence. According to police, the officer on the scene perceived that his life and the life of his fellow officer was in danger. He fired four shots at Mr. Hill, and as Hill was in the process of closing the garage door, the bullets went through the garage door and killed him.
Correct. The first shot, and these are all agreed facts right here. The first shot struck and got caught in the hinge of the garage door as it was going down. The second, third, and fourth match up as if that garage door was closed with Mr. Hill's injuries.
Hill's daughter, who was 9 years old at the time, was across the street and saw her father get killed. And she testified, the family testified, that he had no gun in his hand. So going forward from that incident and that tragic death in 2014, you represented the family in a jury trial in St. Lucie County, and the verdict came back the other day, and it was $4.
Right.
Why?
We don't know. Six-day federal jury trial, as intimidating as you can get. We had 30 live witnesses come in and out. The jury seemed responsive and receptive and smiling and everything for 8 of the 10 hours they deliberated. At about hour 8, they came out and said they couldn't reach a verdict and looked angry. And instead of declaring a mistrial, the judge said, go try a little bit harder. That's entirely what you do in federal court. And they came back out, and this is, you know, they had four lines to fill in. Funeral expenses, they were $11,000. They awarded $1. Pain and suffering of each of the three children, $1, $1, $1. And then found Mr. Hill 99% responsible because he was drunk in his home listening to loud music and allegedly brandished a gun. And thus, he was 99% responsible. That means the sheriff's office was only 1% responsible. So $4 times 1 cent is 4 pennies.
So a 4 cent jury award.
4 cent jury award. And those lines are meant to be full value. And that's you're not supposed to doubly reduce, right? But we don't know whether this jury was just royally confused by some of the jury instructions or the verdict form or the case, or if they truly valued these children's lives at a dollar and their pain and suffering, if there was just, you know, some Blue Lives Matter aspect to this that just they weren't going to tax themselves, right? It's difficult to try these cases in the counties where the things happen, because, you know, like trying a case against JSO in Jacksonville, we all want JSO's services. We good cops are heroes. Heroes every day. Those that take advantage of the system or shouldn't be there. And this cop, and we couldn't tell the jury this, had just settled another civil rights case and had another one coming, and was far from the you know, aspirations we have as a law enforcement officer.
You're going to file a motion for a retrial, and you say there's even a chance you'll appeal this to the Supreme Court.
Yes, we start with the judge. We have some issues we need to take up with her about four or five different things. Then it would go to the 11th Circuit Court of Appeal. And because it's a federal 1983 issue, it potentially could go to the U.S. Supreme Court.
And as you talk about this, not only here on this local show, but to national media outlets, you've pointed out that there have been more than 400 shootings by police of unarmed people in America so far this year, the majority of them African-American men. And this case goes into that bucket of, I guess, outrage over confrontations with police that turn violent and deadly. And implicit bias sometimes can mean that if you're an African-American man, the chances of you not surviving an encounter with police are higher.
Right. There's a perception reality difference. And you know, I had a mom tell me one time that, you know, we were talking about the talk, right? And in our community, and I just, you know, I've got three small kids, I haven't had the talk yet, but in, you know, the kind of white middle-class community, the talk is about the birds and the bees and, you know, making sure you create life responsibly. In the African-American neighborhoods, the talk is how to protect life, how you may not get the benefit of the doubt because of the color of your skin, and how America has demonized that. And and you know what you need to do when a police, when an officer pulls you over, and it's different, right? If I'm just like, you know, I'm a Second Amendment, I have a concealed weapons permit. If I answer the door with a gun in my hand because I hear a loud noise outside, and a police officer's chasing that same dog or whatever it is, chances are he's not going to see me with a gun and think that I'm a threat to him. And in African American communities, there's just this perception that everything, or that there's more of a chance of a threat to an officer, and you know, they are at risk, but we've got to make smart decisions.
Let's go to your calls now for Jacksonville Attorney John Phillips, as he says he'll appeal the case of Gregory Hill Jr. down in St. Lucie County after a jury awarded just 4 cents to Hill's family after he was shot and killed by police during a confrontation at his house over loud music. What are your thoughts about this? 549-2937. Let's go to your calls. AJ is in Bay Meadows. Hey, AJ. Go ahead, AJ.
Good morning, John. This is AJ. I want to know, what was the jury makeup, and was that issue in the verdict? So if you could answer that for me, I would appreciate it.
Thanks for that.
First of all, that's AJ from Mad Dads, I believe,
I love
the work that you do, AJ. I mean, you're out there at the front line. So it's in federal court. It's a jury of six, and then you get two alternates. And if the alternates make it to the end, they sit and deliberate. So we had one black male, two white males, and five white females. So seven Caucasians and one African American.
And do you think, based on your experience in the courtroom, that they might have had trouble reaching a verdict because there was an African-American gentleman on the jury who might have disagreed with what the rest of the people wanted to do?
It's hard to say. And you know, sometimes, as they say, that women are the harshest critic of women. Older black males sometimes are the harshest critic of younger black males. And so we don't know where the dissension was. There certainly there was an elder white male, you know, and well, okay, let's just assume, you know, but we don't know really what caused this. And again, I just can't find a way to analyze what they did as justice. I'd rather had seen a zero on that line and said, go take nothing, this wasn't a case, then taking 10 hours to say, you know, this was $4 reduced to 4 cents.
It's even more insulting.
It is.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of like when you're at a restaurant and you don't leave a tip. The server may wonder if you just forgot. You leave a dollar, and I would never do that, people of Jacksonville, but you leave a dollar or a penny, and it's
an insult.
It's an insult.
549-2937. Marcus is along Main Street right now. Marcus, you're on the air.
Hey, good morning.
Go ahead.
Hey, good morning. First of all, he was not unarmed. Second of all, it's the oldest law in the trial business. If the jury doesn't like your client, it doesn't matter if the facts or the law are on your side. I don't think this case should have gone to trial because the jury just didn't like the guy. I'll take my answer off the air.
So,
all right, thanks for the call.
Let me play devil's advocate. If a jury has to determine whether they like your client, then you're entitled to a trial because they got to be able to determine who your client was. And this is a man that worked at Coca-Cola, had a 401k, raised three beautiful children. And look, that is saying that unlikable lives don't matter. And that's your opinion. We're allowed to be armed in our own home. I mean, this is a Second Amendment case in a way.
Did you argue that in court?
We did, to some extent. And when somebody's banging on your door to the point they dent your door and you're in a garage that doesn't have windows, you know, putting a gun in your pocket or even in your hand. I mean, the deputy testified that it was straight down and moved up as the gun disappeared.
And the deputy involved in the case, was he disciplined internally? What happened with that piece of this?
First of all, because it was across the street from a school, they gave him an award because he saved all of these children. Then he was promoted to detective. So, no. And again, a fact that the jury couldn't know, because you get to bring out the the victim's bad stuff, but the fact that they settled a civil rights case involving this same officer where he beat somebody up a week before this trial, and there's another one pending, and he's had some issues.
Would that come up in a retrial?
No.
It's not admissible in court?
It's not admissible in court. There's lawyers who advertise on TV that talk about those things that a jury will never know. The fact that there's insurance. That's another thing that was in this case. There's $5 million in insurance, but the jury can't know that. And yet they're afraid to some extent in these cases against government entities that they're taxing themselves. But the law is that you can't bring up insurance.
If you're just tuning in, we're speaking now with Jacksonville attorney John Phillips. What are your thoughts about this 4-cent jury award down in St. Lucie County? A jury gave the family of a man shot and killed by police 4 cents. Let's go to Joyce on the north side. Joyce, good morning.
Good morning. I have a question for the attorney. He was in his own house, his own garage. Did they call out, come out with your hands up, his Miranda rights? Or, did they do any of this? Did he shoot at young man shoot at them first for them to shoot in? Why didn't they just wait for the garage to come up for him to come out to see and been in a safety position if he was going to shoot? I'm just saying, you just don't shoot at somebody's house. It's their property. And then not award them for something that you shot them on their property. I mean, it needs to go to the Supreme Court.
Right.
That sounds unjustified to me. I appreciate your answering that.
My pleasure. And they're great questions. The two answers, basically. Number one, Mr. Hill never shot. His gun was unloaded. So he never fired, never yelled at, never threatened, never did anything affirmative, but opened the garage door and down. And then the police officer said he brandished a gun to his side. From the standpoint of what was yelled was an interesting moment at trial, because from day one, Deputy Newman has said, he said, sheriff's office, gun, put down the gun, gun, put down the gun, 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 put down the gun. Well, when you yell that at the top of your lungs, it takes about 10 seconds. And so I had him just do it once, sheriff's office, gun, put down the gun. And it was about 3 seconds. The testimony that this garage door was open and shut in less than 3 seconds. So Mr. Hill would have had a sandwich, time to have it, go make a sandwich. If all of this stuff, because police officers are trained of the magic words to say. And again, I don't want to stereotype bad police officers as good police officers. There's a big difference. But, he impeached himself, in my opinion, and ruined his credibility by saying he said 10 to 12 seconds worth of words that his fellow officer, who was 6 feet away from him, 8 feet away from him, never heard. The only thing the fellow officer heard him say was, hey, which again is something you say when you're surprised, which, we thought Mr. Hill scared him. He fired. And look, there doesn't have to be a civil rights suit out of that. Own it.
Here in Jacksonville, Sheriff Mike Williams is one of many sheriffs who's indicated he's going to work with his force on de-escalation training so that these types of encounters, particularly when it involves a man of color, don't escalate to deadly force. And I want to ask you about that, John. At the same time, we'll go back to your calls on this in a moment at 549-2937. Let me get a few emails and tweets on the air. Meanwhile, Andy in Neptune Beach emails the show, another black man killed for playing loud music. We are living in a sick society. I will not call in a noise complaint unless the music is being played by a white person. And that speaks to this perception that if you call the police on your neighbors who are black for whatever, the data shows there's a chance that could turn deadly, more so than if it were a white family, just due to the dynamics involved in these confrontations. And let's also get this question to you. This is from Joshua. What can our public schools do to teach civility and non-subjective values to prevent racial bias?
Our schools can only do so much. This is a parenting thing too, and in the South in particular, where we're raised. We talk about the loud music case. I think this family found me because I handled the Jordan Davis case, and so here I am with two loud music cases, both just in so tragically, but we're in our little bubble. I gave a TED talk right here in this building about it. You know, we're in our bubble, and we're fine in our bubble, and we're safe in our bubble, but our bubble must reflect and be open to other people's bubbles as well. And otherwise, we're not a civil society.
Lots of comments on our Facebook page. Hope writes, I'm interested in how John himself copes with the trauma of such cases. I'm grateful for his commitment, but know that it takes a toll, especially with seeing this family's suffering valued at less than the cost of a cup of coffee. Paula writes, traditionally, sums like this indicate an objection to the verdict or that there even has to be a trial and contempt for the victim. That looks to be the case here. And Brian on Twitter writes, the same white folks who say they need guns to fight government tyranny tell blacks that anybody with a gun deserves to get shot. Lots of calls. Let's take a few more. Carlene on the South Side. Go ahead, Carlene.
Chloe?
Oh, sorry. Someone told me you're Carlene, so that was our error. Go ahead, okay. Chloe.
I'm wondering, at the beginning of the segment, the attorney was saying that the jury may have been confused by the instructions. They may have thought that it would come out of their tax dollars, different reasons why maybe they would have come back with this ridiculous amount. But my question is, when they came back with this, is it within the judge's responsibility to ask them these questions? Like, did you not understand the instructions, things like that, before he issues the final ruling? And I can take my answer off the air.
That all gets handled post-trial. And so that's one of the issues we're going to address in our motion for new trial. But it's the jury's privilege is, number one, they don't have to talk about it. So I can't call them up and say why without quarter panel.
They haven't given interviews
they
or
haven't
anything
given
like that.
Interviews.
Yeah.
And I get why, particularly with how viral this thing went, but it's the court just looks and makes sure their math is right. And it makes some sense. And if there's no error, it's her job to defer to the jury. They're the power brokers in this situation.
Kay on the West Side. Go ahead, Kay.
Hey, darling. Listen, a lot of times when our white society sees an inequity done by police or somebody else in a school system or whatever, they assume that if you give them people some sensitivity training, then all is well. You can't give anybody sensitivity training if they're racist. You can't give them sensitivity training to get rid of Ku Klux Klanism. You just can't do that. So your talk is wonderful. At least you're opening up a forum. But the thing is, until we have some honest talks, then nothing will be done.
Thanks,
you
Kay.
You have to know that if somebody is a child abuser, you can't give them sensitivity training. They're going to stop abusing children.
I got you, Kay. Thanks for the call. And that brings me back to my earlier point. Here in Duval, Sheriff Williams is, like a number of other large city sheriffs around the country, working with his rank and file on the kind of de-escalation training that studies show tend to reduce these types of tragedies. Let's factor in her comment and tell me what your thoughts are about that and whether that might have made a difference in this case.
Community policing. Here's the thing. Like, after all of this, let me just give you the example of how aggressive this police force was. After Mr. Hill lay dead behind a closed garage door, they brought in SWAT. They brought in some military surplus tanks. They brought in a helicopter. They shot tear gas in every window into the home, which the family still can't live in the family home because it was just so contaminated. And there's videos of just aggressiveness from this police force on YouTube. And JSO is different. You know, we do take more of a community policing model. We've got a wonderful Jax Powell, which I know y'all are going to hear about shortly. And Sheriff Williams, you know, dating back to Sheriff Glover, they've made an effort. Is it enough? No. Do we need, am I tired of hearing lip service about body cameras and saying, we're getting them? If we had body cameras in this instance, we would know. And are they the end all be all? No. But if they can help with one incident, then it was worth it. And it protects the officers too.
Yeah.
If Mr. Hill had a gun pointing out, it would show that the officer committed, you know, justifiable use of force.
Right. And no video in this incident, unlike some others that have made national news. Last but not least, a GoFundMe account has been created on behalf of the Hill family.
Yes.
So they got the 4-cent jury verdict, but private citizens, I guess, are stepping in.
They've awarded $5 to an NFL player, awarded, gave them $1,000. And so it's just a hair under 60,000. JusticeForGregHill.com. 100% of the proceeds goes to these children and fixing this house. And back to what Hope said. And I don't know if that's the Hope I know or a different Hope, but we need more Hope. It brought tears to my eyes when she said it, because, you know, my family does struggle through these. And after I said a prayer with this family, I collapsed on the table and just, you know, I'm bearing my soul with a loss here. This is the first loss I've had where my client didn't prevail. But there's a broader message of Black Lives Matter and community that we need to find. We must find. And so, you know, whether you can donate to the GoFundMe or just, you know, show up for jury duty if you care about these issues. Don't try to get out. We had an African-American sister who said, I don't want to be here. And I was like, please, like, you're taking, we need your seat. We need your voice. So that's, you know, that's where we are.
Always good to have you on the show. Keep us posted on the progress with this case.
Thank you, Melissa.
Jacksonville attorney John Phillips with us today. And much more still ahead later, singer-songwriter Lee Hunter. But up next, African Americans in Jacksonville and the school choice movement. Some real talk after this.
For generations, the faith community was the social safety net that helped the less fortunate in our country.
That began to change during the Great Depression, when the economic downturn greatly affected how religious communities were able to help those in need. So what is the role of faith communities in our social safety net? I'm Nancy Bronner.
And I'm Kyle Reese. Join us for Faith Matters, our quarterly program that looks at today's issues through the lens of faith, Thursday at 9 on 89.9 WJCT.
WJCT and Baptist Health are pleased to announce that Bobby Thomas, beauty and fashion expert and author of The Power of Style, Everything You Need to Know Before You Get Dressed, will be this year's keynote speaker at A Day for Her, Saturday, August 18th at the Hyatt Hotel. Bobby, the style editor for The Today Show, will share Bobby's buzz tips on everything from favorite beauty tricks to her favorite lifestyle finds. For more information or to purchase tickets, log on to wjct.org/events.
I'm David Luckin, host of the Electro Lounge, inviting you to join me Tuesday through Saturday nights on 89.9 when we bring you music from around the world. All styles played, all songs considered. Join me for the Electro Lounge Tuesday through Saturday nights.
Welcome back. In Florida, the school choice movement has revolutionized education, especially here in Jacksonville with our high percentage of charter and private schools. Often, though, when you talk about school choice, African-American voices are left out of the conversation. So in today's Real Talk, regular contributor Charles Griggs looks at how African-Americans are relating to the school choice movement as he welcomes Brenda Priestley Jackson, former Duval County School Board member. Also in the foursome, Ronnie King, chairman of the Jacksonville Library Board of Trustees, and John King, he's principal at Gravely James Academy.
Brenda Priestley Jackson, as a former school board member, How do you see the evolution of school choice? And what has it meant to college readiness for Black students?
I think the overarching concept of school choice is something that empowers parents. So I think it's a very viable concept. School choice is kind of the evolution of the language from magnet programs to choice. Research tends to show that parents overwhelmingly, particularly African-American parents, want a choice and a voice in their children's education. And so choice can be encompassed in traditional public schools. So in Duval County Public Schools, we have there are many choice options that are available for students to go to different schools. So you could also have private providers offer choice options. I am a firm believer that traditional public education cannot maintain a monopoly on education. If it maintains a monopoly, it tends not to serve the least of these, which tend to be African-American students, students who are brown and lower socioeconomic. So I like the concept. I think the problem lies with parents who really don't have truly informed decisions regarding choice options. Mm-hmm. So sometimes it's illusory, right? So you think you're going to go a place that's going to offer STEAM, or it's going to offer arts, or it's going to offer military magnet, and it really doesn't do that, right? And so therein lies the problem with that. In terms of college readiness, I am somewhat concerned with the public's disconnect from the trajectory for K-12 to college. And what I mean by that, we have seen an increase in Duval County and graduation rates, and many have lauded that. My concern with that has been the criteria which young people are required to meet to graduate high school changed. So
you're saying that the goal line's been moved.
Absolutely.
And
absolutely.
In favor of improvement.
Yeah, and so the standards are lower. I mean, a thing is a thing, right? So when we were on the board, we raised the graduation requirements to require Algebra 2. We raised it to require 2 years of foreign language. We made them consistent with getting into the flagship state universities for Florida, because remember, it's a seamless system. Mm-hmm. So why would we not make our graduation requirements consistent with getting in FAMU or University of Florida, or FSU or UCF? Mm-hmm. Those have changed. So it's not Algebra 2 anymore. It's Algebra and Geometry. You know, you don't necessarily have to have 2 years of a foreign language. We are preparing young people to be globally competitive. Yeah. And we know that Black and brown parents rely on educators to tell them what their children need.
So Ronnie King, where does that fit into the economic portion? Because we're talking about, we get caught up like Brenda was mentioning, we get caught up sort of in the conversation about readiness. But there's an economic component to this as well that we're sort of missing when it comes to choice. There are reasons why people are stepping up and wanting to sort of come in and rescue these districts as relates to the schools of hope. So what do you think about how the economic portion has to play? Where does that come into play?
Well, I guess you can look at it in a variety of different ways. So for one, you know, I look at it from the actual parent standpoint. So when we're talking about a lot of these school choice options, I consider myself middle class. And in terms of getting that school choice right, even for somebody that is in poverty, is a hard thing to do. That's a hard system to kind of navigate. And so I'm a little concerned sometimes when it comes to allowing so much choice that we think people are able to take advantage of. But when we look back at it and we really see who's able to take advantage of this so-called choice, it's actually not necessarily those that really need it. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, that's kind of one aspect. But the other is the simple, you know, profit that can be made from, you know, going this kind of school choice route, you know, in a way. For me, there's about $7,500 to be made off of every single student that's currently not in private school. That's how I see it.
Yeah.
Duval County Public Schools currently right now is majority African-American students. So there are more African-American students in Duval County Public Schools than any other race of kids. And so when I look at sometimes school choice, I don't care if you're talking about for-profit charter, private school vouchers, or you're talking about nonprofit charter schools that are using for-profit management companies. At the end of the day, that's $8,000 per kid. So there's a lot of money to be made, regardless of the educational output of some of those students. So those are kind of the things that concern me.
So, John, you're on the front line. You know, you're in the trenches as a principal and of a private school. What do you see the landmines for success for students, in particular African-American schools? I know that most of the students at your particular school are Black students. What do you see the challenges with people and parents in particular trying to navigate this system, and how can they get more out of it?
Well, let me just back up a step and just speak to the fact that the students in the worst situation, whether that be socially or academically, require the best response. So for a private school to be in a lower socioeconomic region of a city, of a metro city, that means that there are a significant number of resources or additional resources necessary to meet the needs of the enrollment. Mm-hmm. That's a large concern for me. So every day I go to work, I'm going to work.
So as you see, do you see that happening? Do you see, even though you're in a private school setting, do you see that that enough resources are being dedicated to meet those needs?
Not currently. And part of the issue is as more business minds come online and introduce themselves to the educational sector, sometimes we can't get beyond the spreadsheet to see the value mm-hmm. of the services that are provided or the need of services to be provided. And there's an education, you know, in and of itself with regard to that. And so it's important that educators become aware of the need to do so.
Thank you so much for being here today. I want to also thank you, Ronnie and John and Brenda, for being here to be on a guest.
Thank you.
And thank you to the audience. And we'll hear you next time on Real Talk. I'm Charles Griggs, and we'll talk to you next month.
Thanks, Charles. Well, the Police Athletic League of Jacksonville, or Jack's Pal, is reaching out to kids this summer. If you're looking for something fun to keep them active, we've got some ideas as we welcome Jack's Pal Executive Director, Lieutenant Lakeisha Burton. Good morning, Lieutenant.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm great. Now, you are leading Jack's Pal so beautifully, which is such a great organization that builds positive relationships with kids and adults. Earlier in the hour, we were talking about that jury verdict down in Fort Pierce, which was such a tragedy. This is a way that JSO is working to do the opposite, to build trust and build affinity with the community. So what's happening this summer with Jack's Pal?
Well, first of all, we have so much going on. I think the Police Athletic League is one of the biggest crime prevention tools that we utilize at the Sheriff's Office. So 3 years ago, we realized that our buildings were at capacity. So we needed to find a way to get outside our building. So one of our big initiatives is called Mobile Pal. And we essentially, everything that we provide on the inside of our doors, we take it into the communities to meet the needs.
Mobile Pal takes you into some of the city's most underprivileged neighborhoods. So you're going to be going out, actually, I think this week. What's happening out at Atlantic Beach?
Yeah, see, we're mobile. We're going outside the county now. We are kicking off our first Mobile Pal with Atlantic Beach Police Department on tomorrow in the park. And we're expecting probably about 200 kids out there. So we're excited.
That's exciting. And more dates planned through the summer. Now, here's something else kids are going to love. You've got a Jack's Pal football camp with the Jaguars' own Blake Bortles.
Yes, we're super excited. Blake has been partnering with us for the last 3 years. And this Saturday, we'll be out there at the Monument Center with Blake again for our Jack's Pal Blake Bortles football camp.
How can parents get their kids involved in this and get the chance to come out and meet him and be part of it?
Well, right now, when we opened it up for registration, it was full within like 15 minutes. So this year, unfortunately, we're at capacity. But again, we do this all every year. But we do have another camp coming up on June 30th, another football camp. It won't be Blake Bortles, but it will be a STEM camp. So
they can do football and they can learn about STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math.
Yes. That's the new wave now, introducing STEM into our sport. So this will be our first time trying this. And hopefully that's the route we'll be going.
And you're also doing a basketball championship in August. And you're doing these, by the way, as I look through the schedule, all over the city. There are lots of opportunities all over town for parents to get their kids involved.
Absolutely. So our summer basketball is one of the biggest programs that we have. We serve over close to 800 kids every summer. So we'll have a competitive basketball league. But with Mobile Pal, we are mobile throughout the city.
Now, the Police Athletic League of JAC's JAC's PAL is really something that is put together in partnership with JSO. It's all about kids, enriching the lives of kids. That's the mission.
That's it.
Yeah.
We just want to build positive relationships between law enforcement officers and the kids in our community.
And what are some of the changes you see when you work with the kids? Because this is such a great opportunity, particularly in summertime when kids need some activity and they need a structure.
Right. So I'm just amazed at how the kids respond to us. They're able to humanize us. They're excited. We hear so often that, oh, my goodness, you're so cool, you know, because understand that many of the kids that we serve come from some of the most violent crime areas of the city. Mm-hmm. So many times there's a criminal element in that community. So there's a lot of enforcement taking place in those communities. So when they come and see us in this informal setting and they see us in a different light, we're playing with them, we're talking to them, we're eating with them, we're dancing with them. You know, we're taking selfies.
You want kids to feel that they can trust you and talk to you rather than, I guess, run the other way.
Absolutely.
And that can be tough sometimes.
It is tough. That's why we try to reach these kids at a very young age. At PAL, we serve kids from the age 5 all the way to 18 years old.
Wow. And how are you liking your job?
I love my job. I've been doing this for a police officer for 19 years. I've been at PAL for 3 years. I love it. My life came full circle when John Rutherford appointed me over here to the PAL. I used to be a PAL kid when I was 16.
Oh, you were involved with the camps when you were a kid.
I was. So I understand the impact that it makes.
What did it have? What kind of impact did it have on you?
It really molded, you know, me, my character, and taught me, you know, how to work well with other kids. But most importantly, I developed a love and skill set for basketball, which later afforded me an opportunity to get a full scholarship to play college basketball.
Where'd you play?
University of Central Florida.
Nice.
Yes, and I took my baby. I had a baby. I was a teenage mom. So I was able to take my baby to college with
me. Amazing.
Yes.
Wow. Well, this is such a great story, your personal story, but also I think for people that have never checked out JAC's PAL, the Police Athletic League of Jacksonville, it's easy to do. Just go to jackspal.com or give them a call at 854-6555. They have a really interesting slate of events planned all through the summer. As Lieutenant Burton said, the Blake Bortles football camp is not available. That one sold out, no surprise. But there's so many other things happening through the summer. You can get your kids involved in both boys and girls. So go to jackspal.com and get into it. Lieutenant Lakeisha Burton, she's the executive director of JAC's PAL. Always good to see you. Thanks so much for being here.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And still ahead, singer-songwriter Lee Hunter. It's a preview of her show this week at Jacksonville's Mudville Grill. Plus, find out how the women with heart of this city are helping the local nonprofit Volunteers in Medicine, helping those without health insurance get the care they need. That's right after this.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with former White House staffer Ben Rhodes. He was a speechwriter and deputy national security advisor to President Obama. He'll talk about some of his more intense moments with the president and about Russian interference in the 2016 election. His new memoir about his 8 years in the White House is called The World as It Is. Join us.
Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Next time on The World, Muslims everywhere are fasting from sunrise to sunset.
This happens every Ramadan. As soon as people know that I'm fasting, they start bringing free snacks to the office.
This filmmaker in New York is keeping his fast, but it's not easy.
Today, one of my coworkers made homemade Oreos. Homemade Oreos? Are you kidding?
Ramadan in New York. Muslims in Manhattan tell their stories on The World. This afternoon at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
President Trump is holding out hope that he can broker a deal to end the Korean War.
Can you believe that we're talking about the ending of the Korean War? You're talking about 70 years.
I'm Ari Shapiro. A look at what a peace treaty could mean for the U.S.-South Korea alliance and the future of American troops on the peninsula. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Seymour Hersh knows more about the CIA and U.S. dark ops than most. He was the first to report on the My Lai massacre in Vietnam, and Hersh brought the torture at Abu Ghraib to the public's attention. After decades of prying secrets from powerful people, he lays it all out in his new memoir. Cy Hersh, next time on 1A. Weekdays at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, all through this year, the local nonprofit Volunteers in Medicine is raising awareness about its vital services and its free healthcare clinic that helps the working, uninsured people of Duval County. And they're doing it through some high-profile ambassadors. Each month this year, a different woman with heart is doing her part to help Volunteers in Medicine. The June Woman with Heart, Shelley Morgan, is here now with more about what she's doing, along with 2017 honoree Amy Boggs. Ladies, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good to see you. Now, this Saturday, June 9th, you're having a heart-to-heart wellness event to help Volunteers in Medicine. Shelley, what's going to be happening?
We are, and we're so excited about this. We are having just a group of physicians who will be speaking. They include Dr. Pam Rama, a cardiologist, Dr. Randy Randolph, who is ageless and wellness physician, Dr. Shrina Patel, a Beaches orthodontist, and Elizabeth Bailey, who is a Mayo Clinic dietitian. So they're going to speak at 10 a.m., but before that, our own Amy Boggs is going to teach yoga from 9 to 10.
You're
going to
teach some free yoga, or
there you go.
Part of the ticket, you'll get
yes,
yoga.
We're having a lovely two sessions at both 9 and 11 a.m. for all ages and abilities. We'll have mats there for anyone that doesn't have their own mat.
Now, the tickets for this are only $20, and all of the money raised goes to help Volunteers in Medicine. How can people get their tickets?
Just show up at the event and feel free to pay then. You can pay cash, check, or credit card.
This is this Saturday, June 9th, 8:45 a.m. at the Cultural Center at Ponte Vedra Beach. So anyone out at the beaches that wants a day of wellness, they need to come on out.
Or even from Jacksonville, just come on and yes. join us. It's worth the travel. And in addition to all this, we're going to teach painting, charcoal painting. We're going, in addition to the doctor's panel, we're having makeovers by Sephora. We're giving sports massages and mimosas and more.
Oh, wow. It sounds amazing.
It will be. I hope you'll be there, Melissa.
Come on out this Saturday for Heart to Heart, benefiting Volunteers in Medicine. Saturday morning, bright and early at the Cultural Center at Ponte Vedra Beach. Shelley Morgan, Amy Boggs. It's going to be great. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Melissa.
Thank you.
And finally, this hour, we want to tell you about one more thing. It's a special evening of music this Thursday night at Mudville Grill with singer-songwriter Lee Hunter. We've got a preview right now here in studio. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so the listening room at Mudville Grill is booking all these great acts, and you've put together a concert. What's going to be on the agenda Thursday night?
Well, I've been wanting to do this for a long time. I wanted to do a show that's not my usual stuff. We'll be doing some of my songs, but then we'll also be doing some songs that by people and genres that have influenced my music over my career. Got a great group of musicians to accompany me. I'm just really excited about it.
And you're known for your folk roots sound. You're also known as one half of the critically acclaimed duo Tamerlan.
That's right.
You've been on this show before. This is you solo, though, along with some friends.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Well, and not really solo. Joey Kerr, the guitar player, is my current partner. We've been working together for about 5 years now. So I think it's going to be an impressive evening because of those guys. There's a bunch of great players.
And you've been touring and recording for years, building a following here in this community. This is a genre of music that I think just about anybody can get into and enjoy.
I think so. I think so, because it's about storytelling.
Yeah, which is what you do.
That's exactly.
And do so well.
Thank you.
Now, this is Thursday night, June 7th. Lee Hunter, A Musical Chronicle at Mudville Grill, right there where Beach and Atlantic Boulevards intersect. Come on out and see Lee. It's a special concert along with an impressive group of other musicians like Charlotte Mabry, Philip Pan, to name just a couple, who are incredible talents in this community.
Yes.
Get your tickets now for Lee Hunter. We're going to close with a little bit of your music. What are we listening to?
This song is called One Kind Favor. It's a blues tune that we'll be performing Thursday night.
It's Lee Hunter, Thursday night at the Mudville Grill. Thanks, Lee.
Thank you.
Thanks for the music. And that's our show. Thanks for listening. 1A is coming up next. It's a new study that says many women with early stage breast cancer might not need chemotherapy. Keep listening for that. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow. If you're listening to our rebroadcast tonight at 8, keep listening for live primary results across the nation. That's coming up in just a few. Enjoy the music of Lee Hunter, everybody, and have a great day. We'll see you tomorrow.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.